Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for September 21st, 2017. This is the march from Leonard Bernstein's Divertimento, a march he called the BSO Forever. The Boston Symphony Orchestra opens its season tomorrow with an all-Bernstein program, including the Divertimento, and we'll bring the concert to you on the radio live from Symphony Hall, beginning with pre-concert interviews at 5:30 p.m. Ron Della Chiesa will be joined by Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan to get things rolling, and then the concert begins at 6 o'clock. Then we'll be back on the air on Saturday for the first subscription concert of the season, which includes Haydn's Symphony 103, The Drum Roll, and Mahler's First Symphony. The opening night concert is sort of a head start on the 2018 Bernstein Centennial, so there will be a lot more to come. As for the program itself, it includes the Divertimento, Halil, a piece for flute and orchestra Bernstein wrote in honor of a young Israeli flutist who was killed on the battlefield, a series of songs with soprano Julia Bullock, and the symphonic dances from West Side Story. Andres Nelsons conducts the entire program, and you'll hear his thoughts on Bernstein later in the podcast. First is a conversation with Edwin Barker, the principal bassist of the BSO. We talked about both Bernstein and about Mahler's First, in which he has a major solo part. Ed joined the BSO in 1977, and I asked him if he had seen or played with Leonard Bernstein at any point before that.
Actually, yes. I was a student, a fellow at Tanglewood in 1975, and we had a lot of access to Bernstein at that time. He conducted the TMC Orchestra, and we did the annual sort of Bernstein TMC concert in the music shed, the Koussevitzky Music Shed at Tanglewood. The thing I remember about that particular concert was that my wife Pam was a student there as well, and she was playing first horn in the Ravel piano concerto that Lenny played. He played and conducted. And we were going together at the time, but he played the concerto, conducted, and Pam had this long, extended, high horn solo. And at the end of the piece, as Lenny often did, he went up and acknowledged the players in the orchestra. And with Pam, he went up to her and he gave her a big smooch, which is what he did. Of course, I was going with her at the time, and I thought, well, I don't know if I like this idea. But anyway, that was Bernstein. He was very exuberant always. You can tell that in his music. You could tell it in his conducting. And, of course, subsequently, after having joined the Boston Symphony, of course, Bernstein was an institution here. The first Boston Symphony concert that I played with Bernstein conducting was at Tanglewood, and it was Mahler's Symphony Number 9, as I recall. And these concerts were very much an event,
especially being Mahler
with Bernstein, who was the man who, in a sense, resurrected Mahler and made Mahler popular in the 60s. I just remember the energy. His conducting was very expressive, not a particularly precise technique in terms of just the nuts and bolts of conducting, but it was extremely expressive, and he could convey a lot with his face and with his moves.
I want to read something for you.
Yes.
It's a quote that I found from someone who's actually, in a way, a colleague of yours from the New York Philharmonic, Orrin O'Brien.
I know Orrin very well. We go way back.
Okay, here's what Orrin said about Lenny. Because Orrin began going to concerts of the New York Phil with Lenny when she was a student. And so what she wrote was, when I was a student, watching from the audience, I found it difficult to take all of Bernstein's gyrations and dancing around the podium. But it was another story from inside the orchestra. We knew that his movements weren't put on for the audience's benefit. He was simply living music that he believed in.
That encapsulates the idea of his conducting technique in a nutshell. And in fact, I've often felt that And he has done this in concerts. He could conduct just with his facial expressions, you know, which is kind of an amazing thing. And that was Bernstein, and he was like that in every aspect. And that exuberance, of course, carries over into his compositions as well. He just lets loose in all of this, and he in the compositions, and he did that in the in his conducting as well. In later years, I felt as though his technique was a little less easy to read. But the orchestra knew how to take what he was doing and react to it, and he knew how to react to us. I guess that's from the many years that he had a relationship with this orchestra.
In this program, that's all Bernstein, it must bring back a lot of memories of individual pieces or of the man himself as you're rehearsing and going through all of this. Tell me about some of the music that you're playing and what it makes you think of as you're working on it with Andres.
Well, again, the symphonic version of the music from West Side Story. I've played it with him. The BSO has done it with him. And again, it's the exuberance and the gyrations. I mean, especially in some of the fast, more energetic moments of the piece. And I was, I just remember, I can't actually show you what he did on the radio, but it was very effective. Let me just put it that way.
Sure.
He got the point across. With the Divertimento, I was involved with the premiere of that in 1981.
Because he wrote it for the BSO.
He wrote it for the BSO. And I do remember Seiji Ozawa conducted it. And I remember Lenny was sitting up in the first balcony, just above where the basses are. And he was sitting up there with some managers from the orchestra, listening and observing. He liked, you know, he was a chain smoker. And one thing I remember was him just puffing away up there. And this was at a time when places were just starting to prohibit smoking, you know, in concert halls. But he lit up. And then at one point, Seiji noticed that and turned around and said, in a friendly way, Lenny, you know, you cannot smoke here. And Lenny said, okay, sorry. And put the cigarette away. And we started rehearsing again. And a minute and a half later, he lit up another cigarette. okay, there's Leonard Bernstein, you know.
Right. Yeah.
But he was a heavy smoker. This, I think, affected his health later on in life. And I remember the final concert that he ever conducted was with us. It was the Beethoven 7. At Tanglewood, and there were moments in that piece where we thought he may not be able to do this because he was physically ailing quite significantly. And there were, in fact, moments in that performance, which he did quite well, and it was very exciting again, where, again, as I mentioned before, he, and this was probably because of his state of health, he literally stopped conducting for large swaths of the piece. Now, the piece is very rhythmic. It almost plays itself. But as I was saying before, the man could practically conduct with his face and nothing else, and you get a lot out of that. That was a very, very exciting performance. I believe the BSO actually issued that as a recording.
Deutsche Grammophon did, actually, yeah.
Deutsche Grammophon, that's right.
Yeah, so, it's with the 4C interludes, which was very special because he had conducted the American premiere of the entire Peter Grimes by Britten.
Yes, and that ties in with his relationship to Koussevitzky, who was his mentor. And in fact, my understanding is that Bernstein used Koussevitzky's score when he conducted The Rite of Spring, or the version that Koussevitzky liked to work from, which was a slightly edited version.
Sure, sure. You mentioned before, I mean, especially the story about Pam and that performance at TMC, and yeah, this is Lenny, his affection, his demonstrative affection for members of orchestras and kind of everybody. Yeah. But did you?
I should add that frankly, I have been kissed many times by Leonard Bernstein.
Okay. Well, you're probably in very good company.
On stage, of course. But anyway.
But beyond the kisses, did you spend time with him? Was he a person that you would have been with at any time off stage? And I know that he's a complex figure, so people had varied different experiences of him. But did you, talk with him, even if it was about music and things, during rehearsals and things off stage?
I didn't. I was not personally close to him. Mm-hmm. I know he was close to a number of players. I know, for instance, my teacher, who was my predecessor in the orchestra, was at the Curtis Institute as a student when Bernstein was there. And my understanding is that Bernstein accompanied him on his senior recital.
Wow.
So Bernstein had a connection with a lot of people of that generation. Sure. Many of them went to school with him. A lot of them ended up in the Boston Symphony and other orchestras, of course. But I was never that close to him. I do know this, that he was famous for after concert I don't know what the word would be, gatherings where he would, and other people, a lot of them students, conducting students or whatever, would talk into the wee hours of the morning, yeah, about music and about all kinds of things. I was never part of that. I always like to keep a professional distance from conductors.
That sounds very wise, actually. So, totally understandable perspective. Absolutely. Yeah. Let's just spend a minute talking about Mahler 1 and the piece that brings the first subscription concert to a close, and one this orchestra does on a regular basis. So, but your solo in the third movement is one of the most powerful moments in the whole piece. I always feel like, because you're alone, there's something about the solo voice at that moment in this piece that just strikes me as not lonely, but just the individual sort of standing. I don't want to get too symbolic about it, but it's part of the bass repertoire that you've played probably ever since you can imagine playing the bass. Is it something that you approach and you know what you're doing every time you come into it, or is there a sense of what's already happened in the piece leads me a little bit to a different direction this time?
Well, I have to say that it is, and I think many other bassists, especially principals who have had to play this, will agree with me. It is one of the scariest bass solos in the literature, and I should also say that in some ways it is more difficult to do that than to play a full recital. For several reasons. One, the double bass doesn't typically have solos in the orchestra. Therefore, we're not exposed all the time like wind players and the concertmaster and so on and so forth. So this comes along, this sort of thing comes along very rarely. Might be the first time people hear you as a soloist in that setting in 6 months. And it'll be the last time they'll hear you in a year and a half. I could talk at length about this solo. There's a curious balance that needs to be set up with this. It's an extremely ironic piece of music. Every bar is its own phrase, and it's very repetitive. He gave it to the double bass. It's a fairly tricky thing because it occurs in terms of the positioning on the instrument. It occurs right at the point where you move from lower positions into higher positions, and so there's a change in posture and a change, and you have to change the kind of sound you produce from that move. And my understanding is that that solo, when the other instruments come in with that melody, in some of those instruments, it's not so easy for them either. I think Mahler wanted it to sound a little difficult and tentative. So there's a balance between the irony of that, and it's supposed to, it symbolizes a it's a funeral procession, an animal's. It's from a woodblock.
The hunter's funeral.
A hunter's funeral. Yeah, that's right.
Sort of like a set of animals that are carrying the body of a hunter out to a funeral pyre. We imagine.
That's right. That's right. And it of course is a Frère Jacques melody in the minor. So there's a lot of irony in this. So the challenge is to have it be expressive, yet ironic at the same time. Some conductors ask that it not sound too beautiful, or in some instances they prefer that it not sound beautiful at all. And of course, as I said before, if one is being heard for the only time in 6 months, it kind of goes against my grain to want to do that. But I understand the point of view there. Also, Mahler, in the bass solo, in the score, if you look at it, he puts breath marks after every bar. And it's the only spot in that movement where there are breath marks after every bar. So each bar is its own phrase. Okay, so the long story short is that for me, every move is totally choreographed with that. And so I tend to play it pretty much the same way all the time, unless the conductor asks for something otherwise.
Sure. What's behind those breath marks? What is he really asking for there? What does that tell you as a player, as someone who doesn't use wind to play your instrument? Mm-hmm. Breathing is part of your rhythm, no doubt. But what is it that Mahler somehow intuited about a bass player playing this that he felt, if I write this, I'll get this?
I don't know. I expect that he expected it to sound a little pinched, nervous. The bass is supposed to also be muted as well. So you have this thing where there are breath marks, it's muted. There are several editions of it. Some editions do not have breath marks. Ours does. There was even at one point, someone has found an edition where he wanted the whole section to play in unison. So I'm not sure what he wanted.
Maybe he didn't know.
Frankly, I'm not sure he was sure what he wanted.
Yeah, but he revised it a lot of times, yeah.
But my impression is that the breath marks add to the sort of the irony of the phrasing. It's very vocal, but it sort of stops and goes a lot. So that's how that goes. And the thing that's interesting from my perspective is that my very, very first week on the job here at the BSO, I guess it would be 40 years, we played this piece.
Wow. Really?
With Ozawa. Ironically, it was with a relatively new young conductor. First subscription concert, the Mahler one. I was very new on the job. Actually, we recorded it for Deutsche Grammophon that week. And then we took it later on tour to Japan. So now we have a relatively young conductor, new conductor, music director, doing this here now in September. We're taking it to Japan at the end of October.
That's Edwin Barker, the principal bassist of the Boston Symphony. Again, Mahler's First Symphony is part of the Saturday program this week, which WCRB will bring you live on the radio, along with Friday's All Bernstein opening night concert. Bernstein died in 1990, just a couple of months after conducting his last concert, which was a BSO program at Tanglewood. That was just a few days after he conducted the Tanglewood Music Center Orchestra, and two current members of the BSO were in the TMC Orchestra that summer. I talked with principal timpanist Timothy Jenis and violinist Wendy Putnam about their experience that summer, and I asked them whether the young musicians of that orchestra had a sense of Bernstein's stature in the music world.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He was a legend. You know, it's hard to believe that we were going to meet him in person.
Yeah, we never really could wrap our mind around it until he was actually there.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I had seen him once before at another music festival when he was conducting the LA Phil. And that is the first time I had seen him. And it really struck me because the things that he did up there and the things that he could make the orchestra do without conducting was something that I had sort of never seen before. Mm-hmm. And it transferred over to the orchestra when we played with him, because he was still doing those things, but as students, we didn't know how to react to it. We weren't seasoned professionals, and we didn't know how to. So it was very an odd experience for us to try to know what to do,
yeah.
Really. You know, it was because he was so far ahead of the music, as far, and he just expected everyone to be where he was, kind of. And so it was an unbelievable learning experience for all of us, I think. But at the same time, very frightening.
You know? Wendy, did you feel in rehearsals like he was teaching as much as conducting, or did he come into rehearsals and say and essentially treat you like a professional orchestra and leave the teaching aside? Is there any separating Bernstein, the teacher, from the conductor even?
I would say he inspired the orchestra. You know, at that point, everything he did was so minimal. He really didn't have a lot of energy, and you could clearly tell that he was failing. So he didn't speak a lot, he didn't move a lot, but what he did indicate, you know, was very inspiring and powerful to everybody.
And that gets back to what you were saying, Tim, that he could do things on the podium that maybe other conductors couldn't do. And I guess when he is in frail health, and so there must have been this sense of his minimalist movements being even more powerful.
Yeah, just the excitement of seeing him there was enough to sort of get everyone revved up. But he was definitely a shell, I think, of himself. He could not do, I mean, this is pretty close to when he died. So, I mean, we couldn't tell. But, I mean, looking back at it now, it's like, yeah, it was almost too obvious. So it was, and then I don't know about Wendy, but I think most of us saw his last concert with the BSO.
Yeah,
it was the Peter Grimes and Beethoven
yeah.
7.
Yeah.
And the orchestra just sort of took over. And,
that's
you know,
right, yeah.
it was,
yeah, it was beautiful.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
So.
Was there a sense among the fellows at Tanglewood that summer that with Bernstein around, was there an awareness of his place within Tanglewood's history, that he had been in the first class of the Berkshire Music Center at that time? Or was that, were we all just too young at that point to sort of like grasp what that meant?
Oh, I think so, because there was, you know, a fair amount of talk before he came, you know, between people who either heard about him or knew about him or knew him. And so I think people were pretty familiar with what the legacy was.
Yeah, if you didn't know it, you did know it by the time, you know, pretty close to when he showed up, because, you know, it's all everyone was talking about, and, you know, the orchestra was all revved up. So I didn't really know too much about it. And then, you know, you talk to the coaches, and they just sort of give you all these snippets, and Vic Firth was there, and, you know, he knew him personally. A lot of the orchestra members did, I think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he just gave us all these stories about it. It's like, wow, how about this? How about that? So it was, you found out quickly.
Yeah. And how many rehearsals were there with him? And then there was one concert that, I mean, he conducted his second to last concert was the TMC Orchestra.
Yeah, it was so, the Copeland.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, Copeland, what was
Copeland
it?
Third,
Copeland
right?
Third.
Yeah.
Copeland
Third?
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. With the fanfare.
Yeah, and we that was the piece that we really didn't know,
because
the orchestra just didn't know it, you know, and
it's
we
not
prepared
record.
In the best way that we could, but it was not nearly where, you know, it would be like now, where it's just part of you kind of piece. And so the first rehearsal was he conducted, you know, what, 10 bars, and then we didn't see him for a while because he said, I need the assistants to like train these guys a little bit. So the assistants came in and ran us through it about 8 or 9 times.
That's why I don't remember very many rehearsals with him.
Right, yeah. So we didn't see him for a little bit, and then he came back, and then we...
But that's fascinating because, yeah, in a way, he was of this stature that he probably wouldn't have wanted to, you know, kind of drill you guys anyway. But at the same time, like, he had to conserve his energy anyway. And Copland 3 is a long, complex piece and not standard repertoire. It's not like what people practice in the excerpt books,
no.
Except for a couple parts of the trumpet part because of the fanfare. But it's not the kind of thing that you probably would have been expected to just walk in and be familiar with. So so then when you transport yourself to August 14th, and I'm assuming this was this at the Shed, or was
the Shed.
The last concert was in the Shed.
Yeah.
And so there you are in the Shed, and you're playing this piece with Bernstein, who was a protege of Copland, whose music you're playing at Tanglewood. I mean, describe the weight of that moment, Wendy. Did it feel like a heavy moment, or were you just so wrapped up in getting the concert done that it didn't feel anything special at the time, but maybe just later?
Oh, no, I think it felt like one of the highlights of my life still to this point. Yeah, it was just profound and moving, and it was even more so because you could tell that he was not well.
Yeah, yeah. And Tim, for you, were you playing timpani?
I was playing timpani on that piece. You know, we rotated around as in the percussion section, but that one I happened to get on timpani. And I was in the same boat as everyone else. I didn't know it, but I did know it at the end. And, you know, like any TMC orchestra, they sort of rise to the occasion.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's so much talent in that young orchestra. And even though they didn't know it, it didn't matter because, you know, you were getting all these snippets of talent and, you know, you hear these things. So I think the students in general brought a lot to the performance, and he seemed pleased. I mean, you know, he seemed like, you know, he was comfortable at the concert.
Oh, I think he enjoyed himself.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He was happy to be up there, and because he did a lot of this when he was young.
You know?
I mean, that was his thing.
Right.
I mean, not too many people did as much as he did with students. So I think, you know, he was enjoying that part of it a lot by the end.
So it was just a couple of months later that he died after that concert. It was really sad. But moving out of that summer, your lives kind of went back to or on to their next thing, which was whatever you had planned, but must have felt a little bit different after that summer with Bernstein. Wendy, where did you go right after Tanglewood? What was next on your thing at that time?
That's actually a question that has kind of a long answer. So okay. You may want to edit this. But
okay. I had just
won my first job, and I was all set to move to New Orleans to be concertmaster of the symphony there. And the symphony folded at that point. And
before you got there?
Right before I was going to move, like the week before I was going to move. They folded, didn't refund ticket holders' money. It was ugly.
Oh, that's a disaster.
And they folded for good. It was never the New Orleans Symphony again after that. So I ended up going to New World Symphony for a little while, and then later splitting my time between New Orleans and New World when the New Orleans Symphony reorganized. So that's the long story.
Okay. Yeah. And Tim, how about you? Where did you head to after Tanglewood wrapped up?
I was still in school. And so I went back to New York City. And then strangely enough, while I was in school, Bernstein, of course, died. And it was, I believe, October, right?
In October. Yeah. I think it was October 14th.
Yeah. So the students, they organized a memorial concert, which I ended up playing.
Okay.
And turns out Wendy ended up playing.
Not that we remember.
We
having
remember
run into each other there
you
or at Tanglewood.
Happened to show up in the
anyway,
same place again.
There we were, yep.
Yeah, and so that was, you know, sort of brought more intensity to that relationship. And then, you know, we were lucky enough afterwards, they ended up having a get-together at Bernstein's apartment at the Dakota.
Oh, wow.
And so we got to see where he lived. And what struck me was that I was in the library and I was talking, I forget who, but it was a relative. And they told me that Leonard had read every book in that library. And I don't know if he was pulling my leg, but I bought it.
Yeah.
Well, I believed every word.
Somebody like Lenny, that's the one of two
totally
people you could
that.
Imagine
yeah.
doing that.
Yeah.
But Wendy, you were in that same apartment, yeah?
Yeah, that event, and especially being there, really helped place him in perspective because, like Tim said, his sister was there, and we met her and so many people that had been close to him, and everybody was in this small little space, you know, talking to each other and bumping into each other, and so getting this, you know, this picture of this man and his life was really powerful.
That's BSO violinist Wendy Putnam with principal timpanist Timothy Jenis. Andres Nelsons is leading the BSO's opening night All Bernstein program, as well as Saturday's Haydn and Mahler program. We had a chance to talk about both programs this week, and I asked Andres how and when he got to know Bernstein's music.
Yeah, it's very interesting because probably it's for me it was a little more different than, let's say, for maybe from people who lived in Europe or in America, because of the Iron Curtain in Soviet Union, and obviously at that time Bernstein was not the any person from America or from Western Europe was not very much talked about. So, but of course, after the independence and after the Iron Curtain came down, Bernstein was one of the hugest personalities and genius who absolutely was present in everywhere, and particularly, of course, if you talk about musicians, of course, that was immediately, I remember, and I still have these these video cassettes of his lectures, you know, which is absolutely amazing, you know, and very much because of those lectures, also orchestra, the symphony orchestra in Riga, and also I'm sure many other organizations, they took it as a great example how to make such a special concerts for young people or for non-musicians or even for musicians to talk and present the music in a way he did with his lectures. So that was very strong part and point how people found out and actually, of course, hugely appreciated and admired Bernstein. Of course, more for musicians and, of course, conductors, everyone, of course, immediately adored him as a conductor and with a lot of great interpretations, but particularly Mahler, I think that's... And also for me personally, it was Bernstein and Mahler was somehow... I remember I listened to many, many interpretations of Mahler, and I got introduced to Bruckner and Wagner earlier than Mahler, maybe also because of the reason of the certain interpretations which maybe didn't speak so much to me, but immediately Mahler and Bernstein, I was in love with Mahler's music, and of course with the and because of that, of course, in Bernstein and the way he was doing it, and I believe when you also the videos, you particularly the videos when you see Bernstein conducting Mahler, is just you feel that he's living every note, and it feels like almost Mahler himself is doing,
yeah,
is there, is the, yeah, spirit of Mahler is there. And And of course, Bernstein was joking. I mean, he was obviously not a shy person. He was telling sometimes, you know, oh yes, Mahler would say, Lenny, very good, done, very, you know. So,
yeah.
He was, you know, and I think he was, yeah, Mahler is one, and of course, and then only, I would say, I think only then came Bernstein composer somehow. And the first piece, very obvious and clearly, was West Side Story, of course, which everyone of course knew and was in love in that piece, and Bernstein and West Side Story was very closely associated together, and that was the first for me as, and for, let's say, for the place where I lived in Latvia, that was the first kind of association with him as a genius personality and genius conductor and a composer, but not so many pieces were also available simply because of the scores and music.
Yeah.
And of course the copyright, I mean, everything was, you know, either illegal or copied from somewhere. So there was no money legally to rent some material beginning of 90s, it was simply too expensive. So that was so difficult, all different complications, you know, but then of course later on more of his music came possible to perform and to hear. In I remember in Riga, Chichester Psalms. I was playing the trumpet in the orchestra. Second time I was conducting that piece. I remember, and I love that piece. It's
a fun piece. Chichester Psalms has got such energy to it, and it's so it's so crafted. You know, it's a really really fun piece to play for sure.
It's a fun piece to play as well. Yeah, and it's so human, and it's in a way serious, and it's also so human. I think it's. And of course, then the second symphony or the third symphony, and then you see them. So actually, you find out about Bernstein that very different. And also now what we perform the Halil, I think it's a fantastic piece. It's very dramatic, obviously, because dedicated to this young man who was shot in such early.
Yadin Tenenbaum, the young flutist who was killed in the Israeli army.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it is, we rehearsed it yesterday. It's really, really, really dramatic and very, very well written also for flute, and the idea of the piccolo and alto being hidden behind or at the back of the orchestra and then like echoing the. It's very touching and very dramatic piece, and it shows absolutely different contrasting from West Side Story, or Candide, or so. Leonard Bernstein as a composer, to me and also to many of us in Latvia or in that region, came later.
Sure. And then when you come to Boston, then it becomes clear to you how close Bernstein was to the BSO. And what was that like to find out just how important Bernstein was to Tanglewood and to the BSO?
Yes, I mean, of course, I knew before coming to Tanglewood about, of course, the Bernstein's importance in Tanglewood and his love to Tanglewood. And of course, Mark Volpe and Tony Fogarty, they told me so many stories about Bernstein and Tanglewood. And of course... all the pictures in the office of in Tanglewood there you can see young Abado, young Zubin Mehta and Seiji and the Bernstein being teaching there and I mean it's and Copland and yeah. So I mean I think yeah I mean I think we are lucky and we're privileged that he was born just very near here and he conducted Boston Symphony and the dedicated the divertimento which we are opening the concert with this piece which is kind of as a present of centenary of Boston Symphony Orchestra and of course his great input and love to Tanglewood, which he loved hugely, and I think his spirit is still there. I mean, as well, of course, as Kusevitsky and all these and Copland and all these wonderful genius who have studied and who have been there.
I talked to one of the players yesterday after rehearsal, and she was saying that she was in the orchestra when Bernstein conducted a lot, mm-hmm. and she said it was just this flood of memories. And I wonder what it's like to stand in front of the Boston Symphony, and especially for something like the Symphonic Dances from West Side Story. The Boston Symphony is, of course, ready to play anything at any time, but for that music, what it was like for you to... The orchestra must have just sort of taken off with it. They just lived that music. They did it with Lenny. And,
yes.
And that must have been pretty special to conduct them.
I was nervous, of course. I mean, not as nervous as playing trumpet, though. But
yeah, we talked about that.
But I was nervous because I knew, of course, I mean, particularly, of course, with the symphonic dances. And, of course, we started and the orchestra, and it plays and it's so great. I mean, and this music not provoke. It just not dictates. It just gives you the
grooves.
And mambo and all this, and deep or swinging and all this.
And that must be
how they play, just not, you know.
But that must be a I don't know if luxury is the right term, but it must be a great feeling for you to know they've got this music completely figured out, and now you can just work with it, and you can maybe stretch a little bit here, push there, and they'll go with it, but the energy is definitely going to be there.
Yeah, no, it is. Of course, it's a great privilege for me to, you know, to perform this. I mean, these great pieces of Bernstein, knowing that he was performing it, and of course it's and several or many actually musicians are still performing with Lenny, and it's a proudness and also, you know, nervousness as well and the responsibility. So, but I think Lenny would want us to enjoy, and we that's what we do when we play this music. We just, you can't do it otherwise. Enjoy and the selection of songs we do, it's so sweet, so.
I think
so
that's where some people will, when they listen to it, they'll learn some things they didn't know,
yeah,
because it's not, just, the songs aren't as commonly known around.
And Frederica von Stade, charming lady in the most charming year, age of, and she's, and also the other soloist,
Julia Bullock.
Julia Bullock, yeah. Also wonderful. And then we have, of course, Elizabeth Thoreau playing the Khalil, which is
an amazing flutist with a piece, yeah.
So it has a celebration feeling from many aspects. One is, of course, celebrating the Bernstein's centenary. Other, of course, is just being happy and enjoying to be back, starting our it's our fourth season together with the fantastic music of Bernstein, meeting again our audiences and playing American music, which is a great music, and being proud of that, and we just do our mission to encourage more and more people to open their hearts for music, and I think that's what Lenny did so great and so fantastically. Is he showed, I think, to us that what the mission of musician, conductor or musician generally, what it is, it's not only you do your part or your conducting, or it is, you socialize, you have to come out from the from the room, you have to,
that's maybe
communicate.
I mean, in a way, that's the best tribute to Bernstein, is that very attitude of joy of being together and being in a place with music. I mean, you're right. That's what he lived for. So, and what I really, it seems like it's a pattern. I don't know if it's really kind of deeply thought through, but I love the pattern of you're beginning the season, but then immediately there's a concert that's just the orchestra, just you and the orchestra, because that's really what this is, throughout the entire year. So the concert on Saturday is the Haydn Drum Roll Symphony and Mahler 1. And I just really like that right after a beautiful, big, splashy opening gala, then it's just you and the orchestra in great symphonies. So I wanted to throw an idea to you and sort of see how it hits you. A friend of mine compared Haydn's symphonies for an orchestra in the same way that Dancing Balanchine is for a ballet company. That it's so pure and so graceful and so organic that it makes the orchestra really pay attention to so many things, not in a bad way, but it really distills, brings down to its essence what the orchestra is doing. And I wonder how that strikes you as a way of approaching Haydn.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I love Haydn's music so much, and it has so many questions. And it's very interesting. Many people, when they are asked which composer you would like to meet or to ask to talk to, and many people say it's Haydn. I don't know. Maybe it's because one famous person has told Haydn, and the other next people repeat the same. But I think. But I mean, I'm very cynical. So, but I think it's there is.
Yeah.
But there is so many things. Of course, we wanted to ask Haydn because I mean, he was a absolute genius, and there are so many layers, I think, in his symphonies. As you say, there is this transparency of you cannot hide at all. You everything, the way you play, the way you sound, the way you articulate, the way you balance things, you immediately hear. You can't hide. And in a way, some people say it's like a medicine, or not a medicine, but like a, you know, the cars, I don't drive, but I know that every year or every few years they have to go the technical...
It's an inspection.
Inspection, so...
You have to make sure everything works.
Everything works. So in a way, sometimes people say, you know, it's the same with the classical repertoire, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, particularly Haydn. And
yeah.
In a certain sense, it is like that, because you know, if something is not right, you can immediately hear it, you know. But I think but the biggest reason is, of course, that I think this music, even though it sometimes can sound and seem simple and very transparent, and because of that, of course, you can hear all things which go wrong, but in the meantime, the essence of these symphonies and the potential of fantasy, what it consists or can consist, is huge. And I think it's very, very, I think, important to play it. And because it's fun, and it develops the fantasy of, and it cleans the technical qualities, and it develops the fantasy to be open to the interpretation of music, not only playing the notes. And so therefore we every season we want to do certainly a Haydn symphony, and then, you know, we did it with Tanglewood, and now we do and Haydn, Mahler, and I, two geniuses with two different period of time.
So one of the things I always, when people ask me, I don't know about how you respond to this kind of thing, if somebody were to say, you know, I don't really know Mahler. How do I even begin to understand the kinds of things he did? Mahler, the First Symphony, is so perfect as a way of... Most of what Mahler did later, he did in his First Symphony. And so you can sort of begin to understand just through that work. Is it the first Mahler symphony that you got to know?
Yeah, it's true. Actually, it was first. And First Symphony was the first, yeah.
Yeah.
And the reason why, at that time, as I told you, I mean, Wagner, Beethoven, and Bruckner were, and Bach, and I knew since age of four, and then, but Mahler was somehow later. It was this was when I was 10, 11.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't probably as common in Latvia as Wagner, was it?
It was not so common, because of Iron Curtain, and Bernstein, Bernstein, who was the one who actually brought Mahler really back into Europe in Vienna, and of course we were not, that was kind of closed. It was a little bit more, we could do with Gewandhaus, with that German part, and a little more Karajan, some recordings, and also Germanic repertoire, which was, and of course all the great Russian conductors and that repertoire, but not so much Mahler. No, Mahler was somehow not approved by the party. So, but the First Symphony was actually the reason I was starting to do the martial arts. And it was just before that, and I was looking. I remember I asked my parents and also some people. I'm looking for then the cassettes, that time. For music which would remind or which would be kind of meditative and would involve maybe some nature sound effects, or which would sound like, I wanted to meditate because I want to meditate and to use the music for that. And the one person who was not a musician, who had a cassette, he thought, that's very nice. And I didn't know who was, I just put on and it was, first moment beginning,
that stillness
and the stillness, and then
all those octaves of strings,
and these octaves, and then it's And in that moment, it just, of course, I listened to that through the ears as I was looking for. I was looking for this kind of meditative, and I found it, the nature feeling. And I felt, oh yes, this gives you this mode, and then the pum 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 pum, and then started the nice melody, and I thought, oh, and then of course, obviously, the other moments are, particularly the last one, more different, and it's, and then I got to know, well, actually, it's this music is much more, and then from that I got to know other symphonies, and but. But I think I agree that already, of course, already in the first symphony, I mean, the journey of Mahler, what he always comes to, you know, through in all his symphonies, in some is more dramatic and some it's less, but there is this journey in each of the symphony, and you kind of in the model. Of course, the first he was a young man, and he. There is more optimism still in that, and more, of course, of positive feeling of. But in the meantime, you know, the sarcasm is already there. This and the third moment of this. Of the, you know, this serious, so the funeral procession next to the wedding ceremony, one street, there's a funeral procession, you know, and that what he saw in his life as a young boy, it's all already there, and he puts it meaning sarcastically and meaning cynically, or I think he already shows his, from one side, as a young man, love, big expectations from life, artistic life, but also he shows the disastrous moments of life, which is a death and the wedding ceremony. I mean, for him it was, I mean, his parents were fighting really, so he didn't see the very happy married couple. So maybe he already had a cynicism about the relationship, and all of this sarcastic, cynical. He already put starting from his first symphony, and I think so. With all the disappointments of life already are there, and. And the last moment, in this is really dramatic. So and then again, very typically, there's a moment of extreme beauty, and there is this. Yeah, there is a model of the journey.
That's Andres Nelsons, the BSO's music director, and you can hear the opening weekend programs live on the radio on Friday beginning at 5:30 p.m. and on Saturday at 8 p.m. And one other note, these concerts will unfortunately not be available on demand later on. A new contract between the BSO players and management prohibits that, at least for now, due to a National American Federation of Musicians agreement. We're hoping this is a temporary situation, and you can find more information about it at our website, classicalwcrb.org. You can subscribe to The Answered Question at Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. TAQ is also on SoundCloud and at our website, classicalwcrb.org. Thank you to Andres Nelsons, Wendy Putnam, Timothy Jenis, Edwin Barker, and the staff of the BSO. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.